Thanks a lot, and thanks for inviting me here and giving the opportunity to speak. So what I'm going to talk about actually partly are new results that appeared yesterday on Archive. So they're kind of fresh, new. So let me first motivate my talk and kind of give the research questions that I'm interested in here. So the setup is the following. So at early and late times, our universe is well described by the Sitter space. And in the past, of course, we know or we suspect that it's described by the inflationary patch. But in the future, it could be described by the Sitter static patch. So we're kind of moving into a new patch of the Sitter space. And this patch is described by this metric, which is static and has a cosmological horizon at the radius r equals l. And it's kind of well described by this this causal diamond. So Gibbons and Hawking showed that there's an entropy and a temperature associated to the horizon, and the temperature is inversely related to the radius, and the entropy is just given by the standard Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And the question is, what is the interpretation of this entropy? And I'll actually address that question in my talk. So the second motivation comes from the vacuum energy. So we know that the cosmological constant is equivalent to introducing a vacuum energy, where the density is lambda over 8 pi g. And if you then transform g and lambda into Planck constant and the horizon radius, then you see that the vacuum energy is actually determined by, well, partly determined by the IR scale, the size of the cosmological horizon. Whereas in quantum field theory, we would expect that the vacuum energy, if you add up all the vacuum fluctuations and you calculate the zero point energy, then you would expect that the result is fully set by the UV scale. So already from dimensional analysis, you could kind of derive that it's proportional to one over the Planck scale, where d is the number of space-time dimensions. And you see that these two results, that expectation from quantum field theory and the the kind of observed dark energy result, differ by the famous 10 to the 120 discrepancy. So the question is, why is the observed dark energy so small? And I also want to address that question and kind of give a mechanism that explains this this difference, although I will, of course, not predict this value because this depends on observations, plugging in the Hubble constant, but I will kind of give a mechanism for why this factor appears here.
Just for the record, some of us would say the second calculation means essentially by definition, your calculation is not under control.
What is it by definition?
If your prediction depends on your cutoff of your theory, you don't know what you're doing.
Right. You mean in quantum field theory, or
talk on with the solution of the CC problem? But
no, I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna solve the whole CC problem here. But I will kind of explain what the microscopic interpretation of this entropy density is and of this entropy density in a particular model. So the third motivation comes from galactic rotation curves. And as you might know, there's this famous Baryonic-Tilly-Fisher relation, which relates the velocity of stars at the outskirts of galaxies to the baryonic matter inside the galaxy. AM is a phenomenological fitting formula where AM is an acceleration scale, and remarkably, it kind of is consistent with the value CH0 over 6, where H0 is the current Hubble constant. So you see that Well, this suggests that the cosmological acceleration scale already appears in galactic physics. And moreover, so this is definitely based on work by Milgram and others. We know that dark matter effects actually start to dominate at very low accelerations. So if the acceleration associated to the baryons is lower than this acceleration scale, then dark matter starts to dominate. So this is Milgram's law, for example. He says that below this acceleration scale, Newton's law would hold, and above, or the other way, above this acceleration scale, Newton's law would hold, and below, he says Newton's law is modified. So if you rewrite this inequality in a suggestive way, then you can rewrite it as follows. And also at the end of my talk, I will try to motivate this this inequality from a microscopic perspective. And the question that Turley-Fisher relation asks is there a connection between dark energy and dark matter? And what I will propose, or the conjecture that I will follow, is that we first need to better understand the nature of dark energy before we can actually understand the flattening of rotation curves. Okay, so my talk consists of two parts. So first, I will actually talk about thermodynamics of causal diamonds in the sitter space, which is based on work that I did last year with Pablo, Anthony, and Vincent, and it's also based on ongoing work with Ted Jacobson. And the second part of the talk is about a paper that appeared yesterday with Eric and Sam van Leuven, who is also a PhD student of Eric, which is about a microscopic holographic description of the sitter space. So I will start with thermodynamics. So black hole thermodynamics has given us a lot of insight into quantum gravity. I mean, it suggests that space-time is holographic. But other causal horizons also have thermodynamic properties, namely Rindler horizon, famously shown by Unruh, and the cosmological horizon. So Gibbons and Hawking actually studied the thermodynamic properties of the cosmological horizon, which I already mentioned, and they found this first law. So this first law relates the area, the variation of the area of the horizon to the variation of the killing energy. And you see that if you put some positive killing energy into the static patch, then the area of the cosmological horizon decreases. So this tells you actually that the entropy of the static patch of the sitter space is maximal. So adding matter only decreases the horizon. And this might be counterintuitive to what you know for black holes, where if you are outside the black hole and you throw in some matter, then the area increases. But that's also what happens here, because if you put in matter here and then you start here with matter and then you throw it through the horizon again, then the area increases. Okay, so the question that I will address here is, can this law be generalized to finite causal diamonds of size R? Because the sitter space is thermodynamic, so you might expect that these causal diamonds also have some first law. And the answer is yes. And what the result that we find actually also generalizes to flat space and anti-de-Sitter space. Okay, so what is a causal diamond? Consider a space-like slice and then a ball-shaped region in that space-like slice centered around the origin of the sitter space. And then the causal diamond is the intersection of the future of this point with the past of the other point. And a usual coordinate system to describe this diamond is where you use light cone coordinates, and our star is the tortoise coordinate. And then the boundaries, the null boundaries of the diamond are at a constant value for these light cone coordinates. Okay. So the first law of the Sitter space that Gibbons and Hawking derived can actually follows from the time-like Killing symmetry of the static batch. But causal diamonds do not have a time-like Killing symmetry, but they do have a conformal Killing symmetry. So this is what we're going to use. And a conformal Killing vector is defined in this way. So the lead derivative of the metric is not zero here, but it's proportional to the metric, where alpha is the divergence of the vector field. So since the Sitter space is conformally flat, it actually has the same conformal group as Minkowski space. And well, what we derived, Jacobson and I, is that there is a unique conformal Killing vector that preserves this diamond. So this expression for this vector field is this one, where du and dv are future pointing null vectors. And you see that, or you can show that this vector field actually becomes null on the horizon and is sort of future pointing in the interior.
And that's what you mean when you say preserves the diamond, or do you mean?
Yeah, that's what I, so that the flow stays within the diamond. It also, the vector field also exists outside the diamond, but yeah. So I guess a more accurate statement is that it generates a flow within the diamond. Yeah, and it maps the null boundary on itself, and so yeah. So it also vanishes at the tips and at the bifurcation surface. And since it's null on the horizon, the horizon is called a conformal Killing horizon. And actually,
here those are null.
Yeah, these are null directions. Yeah, and so you should think.
What is the Sitter? This.
So you should think of these diamonds as sort of inside the static patch.
Trying to see if I can apply, for example, to inflation or not.
I think you can put them in F or W as well. We didn't really study that. But yeah. But then they would expand, and I guess I actually don't know what happens in that case, but so the convenient thing about these diamonds is that if you blow them up, so if you put R, so the size here is R, but if you put R equals L, then you recover the full static patch. So our results actually should be consistent with what Gibbons and Hawking found.
Yep. R star is the same as R?
No, R star is the radius in the tortoise coordinate. Yeah, so they're related by this equation. Yep. Okay. So how do we derive the first law? Well, it's based on a method that was developed by Bob Wald in the 90s. And he derived the first law from a Noether identity for diffeomorphisms. Let me explain a little bit how he did that. So this Noether identity is actually an on-shell identity, so it holds you use the background field equations and the linearized field equations. And it holds actually for any diffeomorphism invariant theory. And it relates the variation of the Hamiltonian to the variation of the Noether charge, where Q is the Noether charge, but it's a form here. And it's integrated over the bifurcation surface. So for true killing vectors, the left-hand side is actually zero. Because if you use the Hamilton equations of motion, you can relate the variation of the Hamiltonian to the symplectic form. And you should evaluate the symplectic form on the lead derivative of the metric. Now, since the lead derivative of the metric vanishes for killing factors, if you take vector field to be killing vector, that's why the left-hand side vanishes for killing factors. And then if you integrate, so if delta sigma is like, so if sigma is like the space-like slice from the, for black hole, from the horizon to infinity, then at infinity you get the mass, the variation of the mass from delta Q roughly, and at the horizon you get the variation of the area. And then the relation between the two is actually the first law for black holes. Now, in this case, so this identity holds for any vector fields. Now, in this case, we're going to use this identity for conformal killing factors. And in that case, the variation of the Hamiltonian is non-zero because the lead derivative of the metric actually is proportional to the metric itself. So if you do this computation using the vector field that I showed, then you get from this contribution, you get a volume term, variation of a volume. This is the proper volume of sigma, which was this maximum, this slice here. So it's that volume. The area is the area of the edge. And kappa is the surface gravity associated to the horizon, which is constant on, you can show that it's constant on any conformal killing horizon with a bifurcation surface. So that's very similar to the zeroth law of black hole thermodynamics. And Hm is now the conformal killing energy. So it's actually the Noether current associated to matter fields. Okay, and K is the trace of the extrinsic curvature of the edge. And you see that if R equals L, then K is zero. So then this term drops and you recover Gibbons-Hawking result. So this volume term is kind of a new term in this first law. And it also, this exact relation also holds for flat space and for ADS. But we don't really, so you could ask the question whether it holds for other conformally flat space times, because these are all conformally flat, but we don't know the answer to that. I mean, this equation holds probably for all conformally flat space times for causal diamonds, but the relation between delta HG and delta V probably does not.
Sorry, say again, I want to make sure I caught it. V is defined here as
the volume of a maximal slice in the diamond at t equals zero.
Okay, keep going.
So it is the maximal volume in this diamond.
So K sum total is the pressure, or I guess you related?
Yeah, you could. Okay, I will come to the interpretations, but it's very suggestive that it's pressure, but I'm not sure that's the right interpretation.
Kappa squared, or they're different?
It's kappa and K.
Kappa and K, yeah, they are different objects. Yeah.
But K is not the pressure; it's something that depends on the radius of the.
Yeah, it depends on the radius, so it's not a constant.
You're saying in any conformally flat space time, there's this one conformal killing vector.
Yeah, I think that's still true. Yeah. Because if you start with flat space and then you do a conformal transformation, then the null boundaries are kind of preserved. Yeah. Okay, so there are two nice ways of rewriting this first law. One is where you keep the volume fixed, and the other one is where you keep the area fixed.
Can you go back?
Yep.
So you said that the delta H is not zero, so you get you should get something from.
Yeah, that's this term is.
So that's why you get the volume. I see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there we use this form of zeta, this particular form.
What's kappa again?
Kappa is the surface gravity of.
Can you go back how you define?
Oh, it's down here.
Okay.
Yeah, there's an interesting story here because for killing factors, there are kind of equivalent definitions of surface gravity, but for conformal killing horizons, they're not equivalent. But the kind of correct definition, which was also argued by Jacobson and Kang, is this one because it's invariant under conformal transformations. So. Okay, so let me explain this picture. So I just want to give an intuitive understanding of this first law, which I like. So if you fix the volume, so say you start with this diamond, you start with volume, and then you put in matter. So what this variation tells you is that you should go to a nearby solution, which now has matter in it. Well, the matter curves the space. But since you fixed the volume, that means that the area has to decrease. Because the space-time is curved. So yeah. Okay, let me also explain this one. So if the area is kept fixed, so let's say you fix this area, and now since the space is curved, the volume has to increase. So you can actually, these relations hold on shell, but they're kind of intuitive ways of reformulations of the Einstein equations, the linearized Einstein equations. Okay, now some interpretations of this first law. So this first law is kind of purely classically derived, but our work was inspired by earlier work by Jacobson, who argued that the entanglement entropy of the vacuum is maximal. So you can actually rewrite, using some assumptions, rewrite this first law into that statement. So let's assume that the area is related to the entanglement entropy of the gravitational field. So let's assume that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is an entanglement entropy of your region A, and it's A over 4G. Now, and it's at fixed volume. Now, the other term, so the variation of the Hamiltonian, is through the first law of entanglement related to the variation of the entanglement entropy of matter fields. And actually this only holds for conformally, so for CFTs, for conformally invariant field theories. And you need to take an expectation value here. So the fields are now quantum fields. And if you do that, then you can, so if you take this first equation, and you use these assumptions, then you can rewrite it into a statement that the total entanglement entropy should be zero. So this is what Jacobson called the entanglement equilibrium statement. Okay, but another interpretation, which is maybe more classical, is the following, which, so for this already applies to the static patch of the Sitter space, and that's what these people, Clem and Fonso, argued for. So I told you actually that for the Sitter, so for the static patch, let's go back to the static patch. If you put in positive matter, then the horizon area decreases. But this is exactly what corresponds to a negative temperature. Because if you increase the energy and the entropy goes down, that's what negative that gives you a negative temperature. And it's not so weird to associate a negative temperature to the Sitter space because it has a finite number of states. And in condensed matter systems with a finite number of states, where you start with a state with maximal entropy and then you increase the energy, yeah, you sort of decrease the entropy because you have less states available. And it could be, and yeah, it's weird that no one else than these people has really explored this interpretation for the Sitter space. It could be thus that the temperature is negative.
Contradiction with on rule detector.
Yeah. Well, one way of resolving that is that this is a statement about gravity, kind of, and that's more a statement about quantum field theory in curved space. But that's, yeah, that's definitely something that I don't fully understand myself.
Do you really mean to say temperature, or do you just mean to say the difference in temperature? That is, you know, the temperature minus what would be if we just had a De Sitter vacuum.
No, I really mean the temperature, but only when you add matter.
You split the sign. Is that what you're using? You're using the same formula, but
yeah. So I mean, think about what I started with. Normally dE is TdS, but here you have minus dE is TdS. So you do need to give an explanation for why that is thermodynamics. And yeah, there are physical systems with negative temperature, of course. So one way of checking this proposal, actually, which would be a separate project, I guess, is to do the Euclidean path integral and relate it to the free energy, and then kind of see whether you could associate a free energy to the Sitter space, but then you need to be very careful with checking the sign of this temperature here.
So this DE, I guess I'm a bit confused. So I mean, the thing is, what's inside and what's outside, right? So you could say if energy is, if you care about inside, DE would be positive. If you care about outside, there is the same.
Yeah, that was one solution by not sure Strominger was the first, but I know that Strominger has written this as well. That he takes the energy of the outside. But we're only talking about here about one static patch, so yeah. Not sure that's the correct way of describing it. Yeah. Okay, so if you would do that, then the free energy of the causal diamond would be minimal, where the free energy is now H minus T tilde S. So, and the first law of causal diamonds can actually be written in this way, where I've now absorbed the minus sign in this T tilde. But okay, whether you put that minus sign in the temperature or whether you just put it somewhere else, I mean in front of here, I think the take-home message of this part is that causal diamonds in empty De Sitter space are equilibrium states, because what I explained earlier, that the entropy or the area decreases if you add matter. So adding matter actually puts the microscopic system out of equilibrium. And this is a picture about negative temperatures. Are there any questions about this part?
Maybe I missed something basic. This sounds a little odd to me, because it looked to me like your entire construction depends on assuming De Sitter space throughout.
Yeah.
And by saying, I can't entirely tell whether you say by adding matter you mean going from one center space to another, and then you're fine, but then it seems like most of your statements are essentially, you know, 0 = 0, which I agree with, of course.
Uh-huh. I don't really get your point.
So if we're always going to say into one De Sitter space or another, then fine.
Well, it's one De Sitter space with matter.
This could be taken to be maybe wrongly to mean that you were trying to make a wider implication of that. I don't know how to justify it with your calculation.
I'm going from empty De Sitter space to, say, Schwarzschild De Sitter space. This law actually is consistent with, compare Schwarzschild De Sitter space with De Sitter space, and you compare the areas of the horizons, you fix L to be the same, then you will see that the area of the Schwarzschild the sitter space is smaller than that of the sitter space.
Everyone agrees with
that? Yeah.
Keep going, I guess.
We can discuss it later. Okay, so other questions? Because I'm going to go to the next part. Okay. So the holographic principle states that the maximal number of degrees of freedom associated to a certain surface S is given by the area, and I've here normalized it with 16 by G. So we're going to actually look at again at causal diamonds with where the edge is now the holographic screen S. I should say first that this principle has actually been realized in anti-de Sitter space through the holographic principle through the ADS-CFT correspondence. And Susskind and Witten actually checked that if you calculate the number of degrees of freedom in the CFT with a UV cutoff, then you would precisely get this area. Now I'm going to talk about the Sitter space. So we're going to assume there exists a microscopic holographic dual to the Sitter space. We're kind of assuming that this horizon or this surface has A over 16 pi g degrees of freedom. But then the question is, what is the nature of these degrees of freedom?
So what surface in the Sitter space are you talking about now? Or are you going to tell us later?
The same, so this, the edge of this diamond.
You want some
of a finite
some subregion?
Yeah, so subregion in the Sitter space.
Okay, which, and now this, okay. Going to be dynamical, coupled to gravity, and all this. Which differs widely from the usual context in which you can make some argument for a holographic.
Well, there's no boundary here, of course. Is that what you mean? In anti de Sitter space,
people try different tactics to make sense.
In the Sitter space. Oh yeah, no. I'm not going to talk about DS-CFT. I'm kind of going. Talk about a new perspective on holography in the Sitter space.
So I was just trying to nail down what you were trying to do.
Yeah. So the surfaces that I'm going to look at are just surfaces of constant radius R in the static patch of the Sitter space. And I'm also going to take R equals L at some point. So we already know that, or already showed that this L has an entropy of A of the area, this Gauss-like the area.
So we're going to limit ourselves to just a Sitter space and look at those regions.
Those regions, yeah. So it's very different from taking a time-like future boundary and stuff, yeah. So the method that I'm going to use to answer this question is a conformal map between the Sitter space and BTZ geometry. So the BTZ geometry is a black hole in three dimensions, which is locally ADS3. And the conformal map is actually between the Sitter space in D dimensions times circle and the BTZ geometry with a horizon radius that equals L again. Times a transverse sphere. So you can actually check this conformal map very easily. So the well factor is this, and an important property of this map, we only relate big R to small r, and the coordinate transformation is that it inverts the radial coordinates. So in particular, infinity in BTZ geometry is mapped to the center of the Sitter space. And also the horizons are mapped to each other. And yeah, you can check it kind of easily that, for example, this term, so if you multiply this metric with this factor, then you get a 1 here and R of L squared there. Okay, so this map actually already appeared in other works. So in our paper, we also use a map between ADS, so with a plus here, and ADS3. And also, if you take L to infinity, then you get Minkowski space here. And here you get a massless BTZ metric. But I'm going to focus on the Sitter space here. So the idea is that we use this. So BTZ geometry is microscopically very well understood using from the ADS3 CFT2 correspondence. So we're going to use this conformal mapping to relate general features, only general features, of microscopic theories on both sides of the map. So in particular, we're going to map the number of degrees of freedom in the BTZ geometry to those in the De Sitter geometry. And also, we're going to also look at the excitation energy per degree of freedom.
Just a quick question. So, yeah. But you don't expect any change due to the, like, there's nothing, the conformal factor?
Oh, there's definitely, no. There are definite, oh, not, okay. So we're not claiming that the microscopic theories are the same for both spacetimes. So there are definitely changes.
Yeah.
We're only saying that some general features are the same. And the reasoning is the following. So we're going to actually look at holographic surfaces where the local geometry of both spacetimes are the same. So so let's say I'm going to look at a surface where this omega is 1, so small r is L, then the geometry is the same, and now the holographic principle just says that the number of degrees of freedom goes like the area. But the area is the same in both spacetimes. So what we conjecture then is that the number of degrees of freedom of both microscopic systems are the same for these spacetimes. And another quantity that I won't really talk about is the number of excited degrees of freedom, which for black holes is the same as C. And that quantity also only depends on the local geometry. But for example, this excitation energy, in our definition, it also depends on the derivative of the metric. And the derivative of the metric is not the same if, not necessarily the same if the metric is the same. So this epsilon actually differs by a constant factor in both spacetimes. Maybe I should continue. But this conformal map could be useful to kind of set up. Okay, so the one of the ideas here is that we don't really know what holography for the Sitter should look like, whereas we know ADS-CFT very well. So we're just going to use lessons from ADS-CFT and apply it to the Sitter space, and then the lessons that I will talk about should apply to any holographic theory for the Sitter space. And some of the lessons are quite strong, maybe. So anyone that comes up with a precise, because I'm not going to talk about a precise holographic dual, so like just give me the theory. All of these theories should satisfy some of the properties that I'm going to talk about.
So just to make sure I understand, so you fix the geometry on the area of some holographic screen.
Yeah.
And then you do a conformal transformation that screws up what's going on inside of the screen.
Yeah, but not
such that you understand the microscopic. Basically, you do this conformal transformation
yeah.
so that the geometry inside you can understand the microscopic degrees of freedom of.
Exactly, yeah.
And then
yeah.
say that that.
At this, so the, yeah, so the properties of the microscopic theory are associated to the surface.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So the conjecture is I can do anything that preserves the geometry on the screen.
Yeah.
I get the same theory.
Not the same theory, but the same.
Number of degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what I wanted to say here. So thank you. Yeah. So they have identical microscopic properties when the wow factor equals one. Okay. So as an example, let's look at these two conformally related spacetimes where omega equals one. Now we're going to start with the central charge in the 2D CFT, holographic 2D CFT that is related to the ADS radius in the BTC geometry. So this is called the Brown-Hanau formula. So you should just think about this as kind of a dictionary for the central charge in the CFT, and then this is a quantity in ADS3. Okay, now if you use the relations between Newton's constants in these different dimensions, different geometries, then you actually get that it is A of L over 16 pi G, which should be the number of degrees of freedom in the Sitter space. So this is just a simple check. Okay, so this was for this omega equals one, but we could also, we also want to probe kind of sub cosmological horizon regions, so kind of regions that finite R instead of R equals L. And a way to do that is to look at the wow rescaled, so to take this, so to look at this geometry where omega equals a constant. So now let's say omega is so this R is now R0, which is a constant rescaling of this metric. And we're going to relate microscopic properties of the Sitter space to that constant rescaled metric. So another way to think about this and to relate it to our conjecture is that you just write this instead of R over L, you write it as R over R0 times R0 over L. Then you take R0 over L in front of this geometry, and then the new wow factor that should be 1 is R over R0, which is 1 at R0. That's a simple trick. Okay, so the gluing of the Sitter space and the BTC geometry is as follows. So we're going to put the Sitter space inside. And yeah, so the Penrose diagrams already kind of neatly correspond to each other. And this is R is 0 in the Sitter space, and R is small r is infinity in the BTC geometry. And this R0 allows us to foliate the Sitter space, so the static patch, fully. So we're going to let R0 run from 0 to L.
So, I mean.
So these are my screens.
You have like a domain role that's suppressed. Is that what you're trying to do?
So I'm only going to look at the static patch. So it's only, I'm only interested in 0 to the horizon.
But so you switch from one geometry to the other at R0. I mean, you switch from one conformal factor to another at R0.
You're not saying this is a conventional Penrose diagram of a single space time, right?
No, no, these
you're
are.
Mapping it through your.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't think of it as a space time.
So I didn't really solve the Einstein equations or something. We don't, yeah, because we're only looking at general.
But if you were to try to solve Einstein question, you have to put a membrane at R.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. With a mass, perhaps, and yeah. So these screens are continuous in our case, but they're not differentiable, for example. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just picture of the blue.
Conformal mapping maps the red to the blue, and vice versa. Is that right?
Yeah.
No, just on the dotted line.
Well, the conform.
Doesn't it invert the radius?
Yeah, it inverts the.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, well, no, but so this, no, but actually, so this Rs infinity maps to this point as well. So, and also this, so some points are actually easy to understand.
Okay.
So this maps to each other, and this also maps to each other. And then the screen.
That's not so clear.
No, it's not so clear. Actually, this on the screen, it's also not so clear. But so from now on, we're going to look at these constant, well-rescaled BTC geometries. Yeah. Okay, so that was the next slide. So this is just another way of rewriting the well-rescaled BTC geometry that I had on the previous slide. So if you take, so delta is the conformal dimension in the CFT. C is the central charge. So if you take delta as C over 6, then this becomes a 1. But with this way of writing it, we can actually also probe Minkowski space and anti-de Sitter space. So anti-de Sitter space is, corresponds to the ground state, and the Sitter space corresponds to an excited state, just like BTC geometry corresponds to an excited state in the CFT. And that's one of the general lessons that you could get from this conformal map. So now, if you would compute the new central charge, so we have a well-rescaled BTC metric, and this well-rescaling, so it just changes the curvature of your spacetime. So first it was L, but now since I take this to be R0, the new curvature radius will be R0. So this is now the central, new central charge. And if you do the same steps as before, using the relations between Newton's constants, then you actually get a volume law for the central charge, which then depends on the radius. So this is in the Sitter space. And you might wonder why I don't get an area law here. Because we said that the holographic principle obeys an area law. But actually, this is not the total number. So this is the central charge. But so this requires some explanation. But the total number of degrees of freedom also in ADS CFT. So so let's say in ADS CFT you are at super ADS region, so above the ADS curvature, then these. So what Susskind and Witten showed is that on these screens at super ADS radii, the holographic principle is still satisfied because the central charge is 2 pi L, but on these holographic screens there are more modes per field degrees of freedom. So so this expresses the number of field degrees of freedom per field. You could, so in ADS CFT you go to higher energies when you move outward to a larger radius. So larger radii in ADS corresponds to higher energies in the CFT. And that if you're at higher energies, you have more modes available per field. And these more modes actually precisely are a factor L over, so in AD, in this case, L over R. So this that cancels this term, and then you get this area term. Okay, that was perhaps a bit, little bit complicated, but just to say that the total number of degrees of freedom still grows like the area. Okay, so what do we learn from this conformal map? Well, this is an important lesson. So the typical, so let's think about ADS CFT again. So if you have a UV distance cutoff in your conformal field theory, then Susskind and Witten have shown that this is related to, so this is delta. This is related to the radius in ADS. So what I said before is large radii correspond to short distance cutoffs in the CFT, so to high energies. So now this is a distance quantity, and this is energies. So if you plug in this relation into epsilon, which is the excitation energy, then you get that the excitation energy is proportional to the radius. Okay, this is all in the BTZ geometry, so to say, which is valid. So this formula is valid above the ADS scale in the BTZ geometry. But what the conformal mapping does is it maps super ADS3 regions to sub de Sitter regions. And if you use this relation between the radial, it should be L over R, between the radial coordinates and you insert it here, then you get that the excitation energy in the sitter grows like 1 over R. So this means that if you are at large radii in the sitter space that corresponds to small energies in the microscopic dual system. And you see here that through this R going to 1 over R relation, the famous UV-IR correspondence in ADS CFT is reversed in the sitter space, but also in sub-ADS geometry and in Minkowski space. Yeah, sorry for this typo. What this means is that at large distances in the bulk correspond to low energies in the microscopic theory. And now if you invoke the holographic principle, which says that if you have, if you are at larger radii, then you have more degrees of freedom, of course, because the area is larger. That implies that the number of degrees of freedom actually increases from the UV to the IR. So if you go to larger, this is in the bulk. So if you go to larger radii, in the sitter space, then you decrease the energy. So you go to the IR actually in the microscopic theory, and the number of degrees of freedom increases. So again, this is different from ADS CFT. This is one of the important conclusions that we draw. So it's also opposite the intuition from Wilsonian renormalization. Because in Wilsonian renormalization, if you go from the UV to the IR, then you integrate out degrees of freedom. You have less degrees of freedom. Whereas here, we're integrating in degrees of freedom. So you have more degrees of freedom at larger radii, which at large radii correspond to low energies in the microscopic dual. Okay. So maybe I should move quickly, or? Okay. So this was kind of using the conformal map. We want to give a slightly more microscopic interpretation of the degrees of freedom, of the nature of the degrees of freedom that are relevant for the sitter space and sub-ADS. So to do so, we actually want to reduce the size of the extra circle that we had. So if we do that, then we can actually make better statements about the microscopics of the sitter space, because then we can ignore the circle, basically. And this corresponds in the BTZ geometry to introducing a conical defect, where n is now our L over a small L. So this is a new constant. You could take it to be a new scale. You could take it to be Planck scale. And this ratio should be much bigger than 1. Now, there is a coordinate transformation from the BTZ geometry that I started with, where phi has this defect, to another geometry. And the coordinate transformation is written here. And the other geometry has all kinds of factors of n in it. So the curvature radius is now small l, but you have a 1 over n squared here and an n squared in front. And what we argue in the paper is that you can interpret this n squared in front as in the CFT, as taking a symmetric product CFT. So Symmetric product CFT is you take a product of CFTs and you mod out by the symmetric group. Moreover, this 1 over n squared can be interpreted in the dual CFT as going to the twisted sector of this symmetric product CFT. So in a symmetric product CFT, you can have fields. So maybe I should explain this. So think about this, these CFTs as living on small circles of size small l. Now, what the twisted sector does, it imposes twisted boundary conditions on the fields that live on these circles, such that the fields now live on the full circle of size big L. That's what's the interpretation of this of the twisted sector. And the fundamental degrees of freedom in this twisted sector are called long strings because they live on a longer, larger circle. Okay, so this long string phenomenon or mechanism has two effects. This is just pure knowledge from CFT, 2D CFT. So the long string phenomenon actually reduces the central charge because it's you started with all these different fields at different circles, but now you relate all these fields to each other. So you identify, you just sew them together, basically. So you identify them as one field. So that's why the central charge gets reduced. So this L, small L, denote the size of the circle. Moreover, so it fractionates the spectrum. So if you would fix, can you read this or not?
It's okay, yeah. Just write big.
So one way to understand this is that the energy modes on the larger circle are now quantized in one over big L instead of one over small L. So this is like an energy spectrum, but now, so one over L is much smaller, so this is now the excitation energy. So if you fix the energy, then you have many more states than you had in the short string picture. So what the long string picture does, it increases delta, but it decreases epsilon. So this is the energy, is the excitation number times the excitation energy per degree of freedom. So what the long string phenomenon does is it decreases epsilon, but it increases delta. And that's what's also written here, that this increases. So an important fact is that the Cardy formula for thermal entropy in 2D CFT is invariant under this transformation, which you can kind of check because the n and the, so the scaling is different. And the thermal entropy is actually dominated by this sector because there are many more states in the long string picture. Now, now we're going to use this knowledge and compute the entropy that I started with for the sitter space using this Cardy formula. So suppose you would take R as L and you use the Cardy formula and you insert delta L as C over 6 that I started with, and you insert what CL is that I also explained, then of course you can kind of due to the 4 pi, and I started with 1 over 16 pi g, you get a over 4 g naturally. So you see that the entropies match between BTZ and, or between the 2D CFT actually and the sitter space. So in CFT language, the sitter space corresponds to a thermal gas of long strings. And the temperature of these strings is 1 over L, which is the temperature that Gibbons and Hawking derived as well. So at a finite radius, we could do the same trick, and then you would get a volume law, because this central charge obeyed a volume law. Now, and this was one of the assumptions that Verlinde made in his work last year on emergent gravity, that the sitter space obeys a volume law for entropy. The exact microscopic interpretation of this volume law is not entirely clear, but he kind of, well, one way of viewing this is that it's that the entropy is kind of spread out over the sitter space, and that you have an entropy density, which is the entropy density is 1 over V0. Okay, let me now come to the vacuum energy. So we argued that in the sitter space, so the sitter space corresponds to an excited state, where each long string is actually only excited with one energy excitation mode of 1 over L. And the vacuum energy can be very naturally interpreted from the 2D CFT language, because energy corresponds to...
So this longest string, do you have a tension? Or do you have a half a prime?
Yeah, like
what's
just
that value?
L.
The tension
so,
is actually
so alpha prime is like the square root of L typically, or
so the dielectric friction, the tension depends on their size.
Yeah. So in the formula there, I didn't write down the Casimir energy contribution, but you can write that. Energy in 2D CFT as like the excitation number times the excitation energy. Now, if you insert this relation, then you get that the vacuum energy in the long string picture is the central charge times the excitation energy. And if you insert all the values that I've shown above, so this is like 1 over L, and this goes like V over R, and then there's a 1 over L as well, then you would get, so if you insert these values, you would get the correct vacuum energy in the sitter space. Now, this is the vacuum energy associated to long strings. But if you would do the same computation in the untwisted sector, so in the for the short strings, then you would impose here that the C is now associated to short strings and also the excitation energy. And then since this goes like 1 over small l, and this also, you would get a small l squared there. So what the long string phenomenon thus explains is precisely this the difference between big L squared over small l squared. Because what the long string phenomenon does, it decreases epsilon, and it decreases the central charge, such that the vacuum energy now has the natural value. So it's kind of is a mechanism that explains this smallness.
But what's 10 to the 120?
Well, 10 to the 120 is just an observational value, which I said I cannot explain, of course, because you plug in L, big L and small l. But it does explain this squared, for example, where that comes from. Because both the central charge and the excitation energy are reduced by this factor. Maybe I should skip. So this was kind of the natural end, and I wanted to say something more about how this impacts Verlinde's theory, but I could draw a conclusion as well. So what I argued is that the sitter space is dual to a thermal bath of long strings, and its entropy is counted by the Cardy formula in 2D CFT. Moreover, the number of degrees of freedom in the dual system increases towards the IR, opposite the Wilsonian intuition, and this is due to the long string phenomenon. Moreover, the long string phenomenon explains the smallness of the value of the dark energy. What I didn't arrive at is that the non-equilibrium dynamics of these microscopic degrees of freedom might lead to the observational values of dark matter and the flattening of rotation curves.
We can definitely have a few more minutes if you could explain that.
Yeah, privilege of the chair.
Well,
too long.
That's okay.
No, definitely.
Okay.
I was going to ask that as a first question. So.
Okay, I'll take it to be that sort of question time now.
let's hear.
Okay, so I'm not. So I didn't want to explain kind of the formula for, but I wanted to explain why you might expect modifications of GR. Maybe I should just start here. The dark matter effect starts to dominate if that's what I wrote down before. Now the right hand side is the volume law to the volume law of the Sitter entropy, and you can interpret the left hand side as kind of the entropy associated to matter. And what this tells you is that if the dark energy dominates over this other value, then dark matter effects start to dominate. So the picture here is that if you add matter to the Sitter space, then it kind of displaces the dark energy, or is actually created from the dark energy. And so it kind of absorbs dark energy. So there is a region around the matter that doesn't have any dark energy anymore. So only when you are outside this region, which is what this inequality tells you, then the dark energy starts to dominate again. So that's this value, or this regime where dark matter effects start to kick in. So if you are close to the mass, then you don't see these effects. Okay, so Flynn's proposal is that the entropy density of the Sitter space turns the dark energy into a dynamical medium. And he interprets this medium as kind of an elastic medium, which is at equilibrium in empty the Sitter space, and doesn't have any stress, and is very well described by GR. But only if you add matter, then the dark energy, or the medium, is actually out of equilibrium. This is also what I argued before. Now, the new thing is that this out of equilibrium state is supposedly not well described by GR, because GR only describes the equilibrium state. And adding matter creates thus a stress in the system, and it takes a very long time to remove this stress in the system. So, and the time that it takes might be of the Hubble time. So the modifications arise in kind of that regime, because that's the regime where dark energy dominates over over the matter contribution. So this is the reasoning why you might expect modifications, and then by computing the elastic energy associated to the stress, which you can find in the paper, Ferlinde argues that you get the following formula that relates apparent dark matter to baryonic matter. Yeah, so there, I mean, there, I didn't show this, the derivation to this formula. Also, there are, I mean, numerous assumptions in the derivation here. So one of, also that's written in the paper, one of them is that the mass distributions have to be static, spherically symmetric, and isolated. So this is very hard to realize in the universe. So one of the things that I'm interested in is kind of generalizing this formula to general mass distributions that are not symmetric and not isolated. Say you have two masses that are moving around each other. What is the formula then for apparent dark matter? And in general, just, I mean, the motivation of the work that I presented was also just to check some of the assumptions that are in there and kind of give a more microscopic interpretation. So there's lots of work to be done here. Yeah, I've only talked about, well, here about galactic rotation curves, of course. So for point masses, so if you take MB to be a constant, then if you take the derivative with respect to R, this becomes, you can rewrite it in terms of the baryonic Tilly-Fisher relation. So this formula reproduces the data associated to flattening of rotation curves. But of course, there are many open questions whether, I mean, that's also the problem of Mond, I think, that you want to understand structure formation and also the cosmological, the CMB, of course. And yeah, I'm very interested in studying that and seeing whether that fits into this picture. But at the moment, we don't have an understanding of that evidence for dark matter, of course. So that's it.
Thank you. Questions for Mendes?
Hazel? Start with, so given that Mond doesn't work on cluster scale, so the motivation is like because of those effects that you're seeing, is that what you think about?
So one of the differences that here the formula depends on MB of R. So it depends on the mass density, actually. So that gives an enhancement of the dark matter with respect to Mond. But it probably is not enough to solve to I mean, clusters are very dynamical objects. So it's probably not, this formula probably doesn't describe dark matter in clusters properly.
Papers are testing some clusters, and I don't remember. I thought they said it worked. I don't remember this.
Not many people have checked this for clusters, actually. Yeah.
I think back to the previous slide where you had the area. Okay, here.
Yep.
If I want to put this part of your talk to the first part, here you have the entropy changing as volume. There you had both areas and I guess
volume. Yeah.
Is it possible?
That's interesting.
To interpret this as the volume factor over there, or is that?
I don't think so. But yeah, that would be a natural idea, of course.
This wouldn't be the Bekken Hawking.
No, the right hand. So the right hand side is only the Bekken Hawking entropy if R equals L, of course. So I actually didn't have time to present this, but one way to arrive at this formula is very simple: is computing the free energy of the Sitter space using the Euclidean action. So free energy is related to minus Euclidean action. And now, typically what you do is you compute it for the entire spacetime. Also for black holes, you integrate from minus, so from infinity to the horizon, or for the Sitter space, just over the entire Sitter space. But now suppose you would integrate over a finite region, radius r, then what you get is that the free energy is T times S still, where T is the temperature, 1 over L, but S is now this volume. So it's, and this is just follows from the Einstein action. So it, yeah, that, so it suggests that Einstein gravity already knows about this volume law. But that's because we're still in empty de Sitter space. So and that describes an equilibrium state. So the modifications arise when you add matter. Yeah, but how it's related to the first part, I don't think it's the same. But yeah, I haven't figured it out yet.
I believe that all the metrics that you use in this talk, they all have a hidden SOD parameter symmetry.
Yeah, they're all conformally flat. Yeah, that's correct.
They have a full SOD parameter symmetry.
Yeah.
Which is hard to see, isn't it?
Okay.
And also, they are related to one another by canonical transformations when you include momentum, which is derivatives. In the picture. So I find very interesting many of the things that you said. And it is related to dualities that I had predicted a long time ago.
Okay.
Two-time physics, which is a formulation of ordinary 3+1 dimensional physics in the language of 4+2 dimensions.
Okay.
And the 4+2 makes the SOD comma 2. Evident,
yeah.
And they are all the same theory from the perspective.
I see.
Of all this.
Yeah.
So they just got it. There is an underlying symmetry.
Yeah.
That 4+2 to 3+1, and then the relation, the duality relations between all these metrics and more.
Yeah.
Is really a Gauge transformation.
Oh, okay.
That exists in the language.
So I would be interested. Yeah, I would be very interested in
some more.
Yeah. Because one thing that we did was deriving this conformal equivalence from an embedding space.
Yes.
And that sounds very similar. So you can embed the sitter in one dimension higher.
Yes.
I don't remember what the. Yeah, but that sounds very similar. Okay.
And if there are no other questions, so I guess just quickly mention you're here until Friday.
Thursday.
You leave on Thursday.
Yeah.
And it's and Man's office is 363. So
I was just gonna also say, have we discussed the dinner? Are you available for dinner?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so later we'll be hosting the dinner. That's
awesome. Anyone who wants to join for it's 6 for dinner. Is 6 okay?
Yeah.
And you're covered by the
cosmology
budget. So
don't hesitate to
come
join
us. Meal paid for.
Wonderful. Thanks everybody. Thank you. Let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you. Thank you.